history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories out there waiting to be told if we'll ask a few questions and take that time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I'm excited to hear the story today from 96-year-old Del Schvichtenberg in Carson City, Nevada. What a story this is, and I'm trying to figure out where to start, Del, whether what you've been through in the last year, you're a walking miracle, or the fact that you were a pilot before you turned 16 years old, or all through World War II in submarines. I guess let's start growing up. Tell me about your childhood in the Midwest.
Oh, I was born in Becker, Minnesota. My parents were potato farmers, and they had quite a drought, and over several years, and lost the farm. And we moved to Illinois, and so actually, from 2 years on till 18, when I went in the Navy, I was a resident of Oswego, Illinois. And graduated Oswego High School, a class of 18.
Big metropolis. For people who don't know, where is Oswego, Illinois?
It's on the Fox River, and it's 35 miles southwest of Chicago. And around Aurora and Joliet and in that area.
Now, you're 96 years old, and you just spouted off memories from the 1920s. A year ago, could you have done that? I mean, a year ago, you had, what, 30 staples in your head?
Well, at that particular point, I don't think so.
You're a walking miracle.
I had bad dreams, too.
Well, we'll stick with the 20s and 30s here for a few minutes. So growing up there in Oswego, Illinois, what kind of dreams and ambitions did you have as a child?
I worked in a garage all the way through high school, a garage and gas station combination for Mr. and Mrs. Ted Sickler. They were very kind and good people to work for. And when I graduated high school, unemployment was 25% at that time. Jobs were just not there. So I went to the recruiting office, and in 2 weeks, I was in the Navy.
Well, and even before that, I don't think most teenagers during that time period can say that they were pilots already. Where did this dream of flying come from?
I paid for by working 12 cents an hour. I could rent a plane for a half hour for $3. And Joliet Airport, it was $6 an hour with the instructor. Well, I built model airplanes as a kid. I always had an interest in it. So I put in many hours trying to get my solo license, and I finally did.
How old were you?
16. 2 weeks before I was 16. And Joliet Airport is sort of right next to a golf course and a highway. In order to land in Joliet Airport, I had to sideslip the airplane over the wires in order to get down onto the airfield. At one point, there was a pilot taking off underneath me. I veered off and saved the airplane and myself, and after that, the instructor, I could do no wrong.
Sounds like you were a natural. So when you sign up for the Navy a couple years later, were you thinking you might be a flyer in the Navy?
No. I had taken a night school for United Airlines mechanic. For an apprenticeship, I had about 5 months left of high school before I could go to work for United. So I finished high school, and then I went to United and Chicago. Here I am. When can I go to work? Well, it's not quite like that. The FAA came into being, and you must be a third-class mechanic in order to go to work. No more apprenticeship. And there's two schools, St. Louis, then there's Boeing in Seattle. So I went to St. Louis, and I checked on the school, and when it wound up to be something like $3,000 and $4,000 in depression time, there was no way. My mother was working to pay off doctor bills by cleaning the doctor's offices, and my dad was a night watchman at a gravel pit, and then he did hauling during the day. Gravel and in wintertime coal. He would go to the coal mines and pick up loads of coal and deliver them.
So you thought you're going to go to work for United. That didn't work out, and the Navy was your next best thing. But did you know that a war was coming? Did you have any idea that you might be at war in a year or two?
No, but I didn't know anything about submarines. So that's the reason I chose submarines over aviation.
And that was something you had to volunteer for, to be in subs.
Yes.
What possessed you to do something so crazy? Did you know how risky it was, how dangerous?
No, not really. Before you get into submarines, you got back to New London sub school, and you talk to a psychologist. If you got past him, then you had to go through the tank with months and long making a send up a rope. In order to start that, you were in quite confined space of maybe three or four people in this little compartment off of the tank. You got past that, then you got to go to school. And there was, I think, a dropout rate of about 10%, something like that. Then when you got aboard a submarine, you had to qualify. And what qualifying means is everybody had to do another man's job. You had to be able to fire torpedoes, you had to be able to start the engine, and you had to have a notebook and the drawings of all the systems. Then you would go through with an officer, usually the executive officer of the submarine. And if you got past his questioning as you went through the boat, why, you got qualified. And at that time, you had a embroidery insignia on the left arm. Then later on, during World War II, they went to the silver and gold pins.
Well, and speaking of World War II, everybody seems to remember where they were on December 7th, 1941. You're already in the Navy. Where were you at that time?
I was at New London on the USS 06 school boat. We were taking out students twice a day, once in the morning and once in the afternoon, because the school is sort of a hands-on between classroom and submarine. And the 06 was not anywhere near like a fleet boat, which was being made for World War II.
Well, and I want to hear about the 06, but do you remember that day, December 7th, and how you found out and what that created in that atmosphere there in New London?
Yes, I didn't remember what I was doing. I was helping the chief wash his car. Was on a Sunday. All at once, the radio started to blare out the news that Pearl Harbor was being attacked. Of course, we all had to go back to the ship and wait for instructions. That was about the atmosphere. Anybody that was on a ship and the school had to stay in the barracks.
Is that something that weighed on you? Did it change your perspective or trigger some emotions to know that now you're going to be at war? And who knows how long this is going to last?
Not really. You had a job to do, and you were going to do it.
And eventually you'd be making war patrols on these World War II subs, which are a far cry from the submarines we have today. But you're talking about that boat that you're training on in New London, the 06. And this is a submarine constructed during World War I?
That is correct.
How primitive was that? How much of a chasm in technology is there there?
It was very much like the German U-boats, very simple, basic in principle. Then I volunteered for new construction, and that was when I went to the Sand Lance.
And before you went on the Sand Lance, you got a firsthand understanding of how dangerous a submarine life could be. You guys are training with some other older boats, and there was an accident there.
When we made a 200-foot dive, the 06, the 09, and the 010, and they dove in rotation of the commanding officer seniority. The 010 made the first dive, the 06 made the second dive, and the 09 made the last dive. And then, of course, the 09 never came up. So we had an audible oscillator that we kept calling for several days, trying to get a response. The submarine rescue vessel out of New London came up and a diver went down and the 09 was crushed amidships. And they tapped on the hull and didn't get any response. About two or three days later, the Secretary of the Navy came up and declared it a sacred tomb. And it was in 438 feet of water at that time. Now it's moved out to about 1,200 feet or more.
And there are 28 sailors still entombed on it?
Oh, yes. A diver could only do about 10 or 15 minutes at the depth, and then it took them hours to decompress coming back up.
And I'm guessing, now this is just a guess, I'm imagining that you probably knew a fair amount of those 28 men.
Yes, most of us were either in the class or lived together in Philadelphia when we were recommissioning. We lived above the reserve barracks, and so we got pretty close together.
So these are young men just like you, and before they've even gone off to war, they've lost their lives. How did you handle that? That's got to be really tough to deal with.
Well, it was, and it's very similar to sinking Japanese ships. You think about the amount of lives that were lost.
And I don't want to linger too long on this situation, but you lose a whole boat and 28 men, and it's a sub just like yours. Is there a thought that goes through your mind, hey, that could have been me, or that could be me in the future?
Oh, yeah. You probably lost a couple nights' sleep.
And you haven't gone off to war yet, but there's something that you did before your first war patrol. You got married. What was that all about?
We'd been going together in high school. My mother was in the hospital, actually, and I went back to see her, and in 5 days, got married and had to drive back to New London. The priest had to go to Chicago, got a dispensation in order to marry us. We got to the church, and the license was home on the piano. So we got married quite late in the evening. Then almost immediately had to leave for New London. Then I reported into New London, and then we had to find a place to live. And we lived in Norwich, Connecticut, in a home. This lady had lost her husband. We had kitchen privileges and a bedroom and a bath. This lady's washing machine didn't work. Her vacuum didn't work. In our bedroom, we had pieces of washing machine and vacuum cleaner. And I'd order parts, and as the parts would come in, I'd put it back together. It was an Italian lady. Her name was Ferry. They had a grocery store at one time. But anyway, she was a nice lady.
Well, and I'm thinking I probably know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I guess if you got married without even knowing where you were going to live in New London, you probably didn't think it through to consider, hey, I'm marrying this girl, but I might not come back home to her. I'm going off to a war that could kill me. Did that thought at all enter your mind that there was a chance she was going to be a young widow?
Yes, but she was willing, so, and she lived with her mother during World War II. And, of course, mail service wasn't too good. It was about every 2 or 3 months she would get a letter, and that letter would be censored before it left the ship. So there wasn't much you could write.
And as we start to dive into some of the stories you have from submarines during World War II, maybe we should underscore for people just how significant this danger was. I know you used to be a docent on the Pampanito there in San Francisco, which people can still visit and get a taste of a World War II sub today. Maybe there's some people listening right now who saw you there and heard from you the statistics for submarines in World War II. How many were lost, and what a big percentage that was of the guys who actually served on subs.
Well, to start out, the submarine force was less than 2% of the Navy. We sank over half of the Japanese fleet, and we lost 52 submarines out of a possible 249. Roughly 3,500 men were lost on the 52 submarines, and some of them died in prison camps. So, and I don't think we have a good figure of that.
Of how many died in captivity?
In captivity.
Well, and I know there are some points in your story where you came close to joining those 3,500 who never came back, and you probably weren't too far away from potentially being a POW either, with one story I know we're going to hear if you didn't come through and do what you did to earn the Bronze Star. But what about the capabilities of these subs and the limitations of these submarines as far as how long you could submerge?
We would be submerged all day. We'd have to come up at night in order to charge batteries and charge air because we had 5 air banks. And so those 2 air banks would have to be charged that night. When we would go on patrol, we'd have 24 torpedoes on board. We'd have roughly 2 to 3 months' stores on board. And when we got rid of the 24 torpedoes, that was the end of the patrol. And so sometimes we would be out there almost 3 months and get pretty short of food and supplies and even fuel. Now, the fuel, we carried enough fuel to go halfway around the world, 11,800 miles of diesel fuel. Sometimes we'd come in, we'd have maybe 500 gallons left.
We're starting to get the picture, and we'll hear more about what Del Schvichtenberg did aboard that World War II submarine when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Del Schvichtenberg of Carson City, Nevada, a Navy veteran of World War II who volunteered to serve on submarines. We're going to hear about some of the close calls he survived in a Navy career that continued till 1960 when he retired as a chief warrant officer. Why don't you take us back, Del, to that World War II duty on the USS Sand Lance, SS 381. What were you responsible for on that boat?
Well, I was in charge of damage control, for one thing. I was chief auxiliaryman on the 381. Auxiliary gang had everything mechanical except for the engines and the distillers for fresh water. Everything else, mechanical, hydraulics, air conditioning, ice machine, periscopes.
We're going to hear about that. And the Sandlance was a very accomplished boat in the war. Presidential unit citation. How many enemy ships did you guys sink?
I think it was around 16 or 18. There's a question as to exactly whether, and some were sunk and some were damaged.
And if you're sinking all these ships, and if you can't stay submerged, you have to surface every night. And when you do hit a ship with a torpedo, they know you're in the area. So you guys must have been in a fair amount of danger yourselves.
We sank one ship that we never got a depth charge afterwards, and that was in the Celebes. The convoy kept going and never deviated, and about that time we had cables going down the side. We were in the middle of a minefield, so that was the reason we never got a depth charge after sinking that one.
So you can hear the cables scraping outside, or what?
Oh, yeah, and you can hear the propellers. And you could hear the depth charges hit the water. Then you heard the igniter engage. And then you got the big bang.
I'm sure it depends on how close you are to the depth charge detonating. But what does that feel like inside a submarine when that's happening around you?
Sometimes you would look down at your feet in the deck, and you'd be a half 6 inches up off the deck from the movement at the submarine.
So it would shake the sub so bad, you guys are all literally lifted up into the air off the floor.
Right, and brake light bulbs. There's all kinds of things that would happen. Sword arm, which tells you what speed you're going at, was cranked down on a motorcycle chain and then locked down with a positive lock, and a little over 400 feet in a depth charge attack, it broke that motorcycle chain and the forward torpedo room started to flood. It looked like it was coming down from the torpedo loading hatch. But instead of that, it was shooting up and hitting the overhead and spreading out from the sword arm. We didn't realize where it was coming from. And the loading hatch was always full of dirty laundry of the people lived up in the torpedo room. So that took up a little time to get that out of there. But then, in the meantime, we spotted the sword arm, which looked like a rainbow, and was able to close the valves and secure the flooding.
You were in charge of that damage control?
Yes, secured the forward torpedo room.
Now, I don't want to overstate or understate this, but this is high stakes. You got a lot of lives on that boat that are going to be lost if you don't contain this leak, right?
That's correct.
So were you a little anxious, nervous, scared?
To a certain point, yes. You'd be pretty foolish if you didn't think about it.
And how much time do you think you had? Had you not stopped that leak, how long would it have taken to doom you all?
At one time, I didn't think I'd ever live to be 23, and here I am at 96.
You think that was the closest call you guys had down there?
One of them. On the third patrol, we got an aerial bomb that was a hit. It had to be a hit because the port shaft was forced out of alignment by 18 degrees, ruined the reduction gear, and we had a hot run in the number 8 torpedo tube, which was an electric torpedo in there, that we were going to fire at the ship when the Zero spotted us and bombed us. And the hot run in the torpedo tube, the torpedo expanded. We had no idea what condition the igniter, because there's a little impeller that the water arms it with. And if that was being armed due to the circulation of water.
And if it is armed, it's going to blow you guys all to smithereens.
That's right. And it took 600 pounds of air to get rid of that torpedo. and 8 seconds later it went off. Actually, when that happened, that sort of called off the destroyers that were depth charging us at the same time. They thought that we'd blown up. They dropped their search. So we had to go from Australia to Mare Island on one propeller. We were out of action for 8 months, or otherwise we'd have been one of the top submarines of World War II.
So you're about to attack a Japanese convoy. You've got the torpedo armed in the tube. When a bomb hits you guys, the torpedo is stuck in the tube.
We were trying to fire at the same time the bomb went off. So we didn't know whether that torpedo was half in, half out, or what.
And whose job was it to figure that out and get it loose?
Well, we had no choice. All the torpedo men, of course. You could tell that the tube was warm and hot, and also that you couldn't get rid of it with 200 pounds of pressure. Ordinarily, you'd no problem with a couple hundred pounds of pressure.
So how do you do that? How do you apply more pressure to expend that torpedo?
Manually.
So that's what the torpedo men are doing?
Right.
And where are you while this is going on?
I was probably in the control room. The auxiliary gang is in the pump room or underneath the control room usually. And we also took care of the air manifolds for surfacing and diving.
And so you say you're not sure if it's armed or not. You guys force it out. 8 seconds later, it goes off. Now, does that mean that it would have gone off in the tube had you guys not gotten it out of there? Or was it the rushing water from it being shot out that set it off?
Nobody knows. It just happens. You have no way you can see it, feel it, or anything else. It's the only thing you can go by is the tube was still hot. You know that it hadn't went out when you build up pressure to 200, 300, 400, and finally got rid of it at 600 pounds.
So who knows how close you were to all you guys being killed right there. But then when it gets away and goes off, it tricks the Japanese into thinking you guys are done for.
Yeah, that is correct.
So it maybe saved your life.
Yeah, that is right.
That's a little crazy, isn't it?
Well, yes. A lot of it is you have a guardian angel or somebody looking after you or over you. Or beginning of the war, we had an awful lot to learn. We really didn't know what we were up against. To give you an idea how far-fetched the Japanese were, they would even drop an anchor and try and hook it onto the submarine. They did hook it onto the thresher back by the stern planes and around the propeller. That anchor managed to get a hold of the thresher.
Well, yeah, there's so many different dangers you're faced with. And I'm wondering, as you describe how damaged your boat was after that incident, and you said you had to go all the way back, was that dangerous? Were you guys in danger because you were going so slow?
Well, yes, and on the surface. Matter of fact, we passed a English tanker, and the lookouts reported they signaled. Well, by that time, that signal lit right in front of us. They fired across our bow. Well, the skipper got on the radio, and we got apologies all the way back to Mare Island.
I believe it. Well, and we haven't even talked about the incident for which you were awarded the Bronze Star. And to be in your position on a submarine and receive an award like that is fairly unique. Tell me what happened.
Well, we were in the Sea of Okhotsk, which is right between the Sea of Japan and the Russian naval base. We had this convoy come through with two Japanese destroyers and two freighters, unmarked, no flags. We sank them. They were both Russian. But in making this attack, we also had icebergs that were floating along and hit the number one periscope, which was the attack scope, Bennett. and it could only go down a few inches. It was jammed, in other words. So the only thing we could do was cut out the upper bearing in order to get a bigger diameter to take care of some of that bend to keep the feather from that scope going over the other scope, rendering it useless.
Well, and I know this is old hat and obvious to you, but most people listening have never been on a submarine. They don't know how periscopes work. They don't know the impact of this. So can you spell out for us why that was such a severe problem to have that periscope bent?
Well, the periscope is the only connection you have with the outside world to know whether there's ships up there, where they're at, airplanes, whatever you can see. Airplanes usually came in with the sun, and you didn't see them anyhow.
Well, having that periscope bent put severe limitations on the operability of this sub and put all your lives in danger.
That is correct. With the bent one, it puts a feather of water up over the second one, which rendered it useless. So that was the reason we had to get the bent one down to where that feather of water would not go over the second periscope. We had two periscopes. In case one was out of commission, we had another one we could fall back on. One was an attack, which was a very small lens at the top. And the second one was a little stubbier, so there were two different kinds. One of them had radar on it, and the other one didn't. The attack didn't.
But so you guys have to stay on the surface while you try to fix this, right?
That is correct.
And that puts you in danger.
Yes, we had an air attack. We just barely got up on top of the periscope shears. This was when the skipper took it out 25 miles from the coast of Japan. My second class was an Indian, and he had a good eyesight, and he spotted this plane coming in from Japan, a Coast Guard patrol. So by the time we got down going through the conning tower hatch, that was the first radar contact we had with it, and that was 10 miles. Well, at the speed those Zeros flew, 10 miles don't take very long.
So you're up on top of the boat trying to fix this periscope, and there's a plane coming in, so you have to hustle down below and hope they don't hit you?
Yeah, and we were up about 45 feet above the waterline, and the lookouts were halfway in between.
So what happened when the plane came in?
He went past, came back in with the sun where he could see us. We were actually too close to him when he came over the first time. So he turned around and came in with the sun, and they could see you down to 100 feet, a silhouette, on a good sunshiny day. And he dropped two bombs, near misses, but he got rid of his bomb load.
Well, I think the obvious question is, how did he miss you? Weren't you a sitting duck?
Not really. We had probably 100 feet of water above us.
So you were able to submerge a little bit because you saw him coming?
Oh, yeah. No. We submerged immediately. And like I said, when we cleared the conning tower, the radar had him at 10 miles. And then they had to get the lookouts down and the OD down. We went right on down to 100 feet.
So if your buddy, your second class man, hadn't spotted it when he did, you wouldn't have been down 100 feet.
Probably not.
And you might not be here.
Yeah, right.
So that plane's gone, but you don't know when another one's coming?
The captain went out to 50 miles then, and we moved south to a new area anyway. In other words, we didn't lose too much time between the time that we were working on the periscope to the next station, which was right off of Yokohama Bay.
And so to actually fix it, what did you have to do?
Well, we had to go back Pearl Harbor.
But in the moment, how did you remedy the situation?
We cut out the upper bushing, which was about a 30-inch bronze bushing, which kept that periscope steady when it was raised. and our periscope depth was roughly 60 feet. So from 45 to 60, there were about 15 feet of periscope.
So again, you have to surface, and you guys go up there?
We had to drill little holes. The only equipment we had was what we left with, and that was electric drill and a bunch of drill bits and cold chisels and hammers.
So a little bit at a time.
Yeah, one drill, and we'd get a pocket full of those drills, go down and sharpen them, and then go back up. And this is in the middle of a snowstorm.
And this is something we're going to have to hear more about after the break. Del Schvichtenberg, 96 years old, of Carson City, Nevada, is our guest today. You can find photos of him then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a talk with incredibly sharp 96-year-old Navy veteran Del Schvichtenberg. When we left off, Del was telling us about the events that led to his being awarded the Bronze Star with Combat V for Valor. It was in early 1944. His submarine, the USS Sand Lance, had sustained damage to its attack periscope, and that would not retract. Del had to find a way to fix the problem before the enemy could take them out. And when we stepped away there, he shared he was out there working on this periscope in a snowstorm. You're talking about this like it's no big deal, but you've just been bombed by an airplane. You've got to get this fixed. You don't know if there are other planes coming in or a ship could spot you and fire at you. You're wearing out drill bit after drill bit trying to get a little piece of this off at a time. And it's snowing on you the whole time?
That is correct. It was very miserable as far as weather was concerned.
How long did it take you guys with a little, you know, fraction of an inch at a time to get that done?
2 days and two nights we worked on that periscope. And fortunately, we weren't attacked after that first day.
And did you get any sleep in those 2 days?
Few minutes nap.
What was going through your mind while you're working on that? I mean, because you don't know if you're ever going to get it done or if you're going to finish in time or if you're going to survive this.
We didn't have any choice. It was going to take so long in order to drill two strips of that bushing. We had to take it off in two pieces. And so we had to make two cuts. I was on one side and Cabby was on the other. And we were drilling in chiseling and then spreading, and we had jack screws would help to pull this thing up and spread it out. We had to make those from scratch. We were just fortunate. On the way leaving Portsmouth, we were walking back to the ship, and here was a trash barrel outside the machine shop with a bunch of miscellaneous metal in it. And we just happened to pull out two or three pieces, long pieces, maybe 2 or 3 feet long, of half-inch steel. And that was our jack screws. We had to shred those and use those. Then we're just fortunate that we took it out of that trash barrel before we left Portsmouth.
And again, I don't want to exaggerate here, but it kind of sounds like you were faced with an impossible task that you didn't have the right tools to accomplish.
First of all, you need a crane to get that scope out of the way in the first place.
Which you didn't have.
We didn't have, no. And we didn't have very good weather. We had a lot against us.
It kind of reminds me of that question, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. I mean, you were eating a pretty big elephant there.
That is correct. The hardest way you possibly could do it.
And were there moments within those couple days as the snow's falling, your hands are freezing up, you're trying to drill through this thing, that you thought it's not going to happen?
Those are the times when you took the drill bits and went down and sharpened them and maybe grabbed a couple winks of sleep, a couple of coffee or something.
Well, I have to imagine when you finally got it out of there and remedied that problem, that had to feel pretty satisfying.
It did. It did the job, and we were able to complete the patrol run. We sank a good number of ships after that. We got a cruiser, and we got a tanker, and we got a transport out of a convoy. And the cruiser that we got, the torpedo went under the target, got on the other side, and that's where the cruiser was. We got the cruiser, but wasn't really shooting at him in the first place. Anyway, we got three ships. We'd wasted six torpedoes, three one day at a Q-boat and three the next day at another Q-boat. The torpedo depth was set at 3 feet, and they watched it go underneath them. And so that was one of the first clues that we could go back, or the captain could go back to the admiral and say the torpedoes are running deep, because we were having torpedo problems. Plus, we were trying to shoot it too far away. We fired at roughly 1,000 yards, a half mile. First part of the war, they were figuring they had 2 miles of torpedo run. Well, you might have had 2 miles of torpedo run, but not at the speed you're going.
You know, I'm thinking I should read your citation here. They gave you the Bronze Star, signed by Admiral Nimitz, and the citation says, for meritorious service in action, when his outstanding performance of duty in working 2 days and nights on top of the periscope shears, part of the time in a heavy snowstorm, and under the threat of Japanese air attack, cutting away the upper bearing to allow the lowering of number one periscope, which had bent and jammed in the raised position, aided his commanding officer materially in the sinking of over 28,000 tons and the damaging of 6,000 tons. And maybe it's just me, but I'm thinking the bigger impact there, yeah, you sank a lot of ton of enemy shipping, but didn't you guys also save the lives of everybody on that boat?
Oh, yes.
That's a pretty big deal.
Well, the third patrol was more dangerous than this first one, but none of them were a picnic, let's put it that way. Every time we sank a ship, we were bound to get at least 25 depth charges. And if there were two destroyers, at one point, we were held down 15 hours and 105 depth charges. You don't sleep doing that. That was on the first patrol run after we got to Yokohama Bay.
Well, that, it sure seems like a helpless feeling when that's going on. I've got to ask you, though. I'm looking at a picture here of a young sailor with a Bronze Star pinned to his chest and a pretty good look of satisfaction on his face. How did you find out they were giving you the Bronze Star, and what was that like to have an admiral pin it on your uniform?
Well, it's an honor. You feel appreciated.
I guess another question that comes to mind is, how exhausted were you after those 2 days and nights in that snowstorm?
Well, after we got warmed up, we got a good night's sleep. But then we went right on into the Q-boats and then the convoy. And we were forced down at 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of a battery charge. We surfaced a couple hours later, and we were forced down again with the aerial zeros. Then the sonar reported propellers all around us. We were right in the middle of the convoy. We had 8 torpedoes left and fired all 8, and we got 3 ships.
There seems to be a recurring theme as I listen to some of your stories. You had a lot working against you. Have you ever looked back at everything you did in World War II and say, how in the world did I make it through all of that?
I consider myself very lucky. Like I said, I think I've had a guardian angel looking after me several times in my lifetime.
What was it like to hear that Japan had finally surrendered?
Well, 3 days after that, we had a torpedo fired at us. They didn't give up easy. And the only reason they didn't hit us was that we were dead in the water. And they thought we were making speed. Now, going back to give somebody an idea of our submerged speed, which is 3 knots, which is walking speed. Anybody that can walk 3 miles in an hour, that's what our speed was. And our first patrol, the first ship we got, we were in about 50 feet of water. And we had about, 5 miles to get to deep water at 3 knots. And fortunately, the destroyers made a circle around the ship that was sunk, dropping depth charges, killing everybody that was in the water. But it gave us time to get headed for deep water. And we lost one sound head and the sword arm on that 50 feet of water, trying to get to deep water.
And you're saying 3 days after Japan surrendered, somebody shot a torpedo at you guys, and had you been moving, they would have hit you.
That is correct.
Was that a plane that fired it or a ship?
Another sub. What we were doing was shooting at belly tanks. The airplanes had dropped, so we were dead in the water. Well, people were just up there trying to shoot these belly tanks and sink them.
You were kind of goofing off and celebrating now that the war was over?
Yeah, sort of, you might say that. Recreation in a different way.
And then somebody spotted the fish heading your way?
Yeah, that is correct. We had a torpedo detector, which was one of our latest alterations, and it passed right ahead of us.
I guess that puts a damper on the celebration.
Yes, it did. Yeah, we spent a little bit more time in the daytime submerged.
Well, I have to imagine it had been a long time since you'd seen that young lady you married and didn't have much time with before you headed off to war.
Yeah, she was living with her mother, so I knew she was in good hands, and she was a beautician and working in a department store, actually.
Maybe this is a hard one to answer, but it comes to mind. I'm just curious. How many times you think you wondered while you're out there on all those patrols and all these hazards and dangers that we've talked about were coming your way? How many times did you wonder, hey, am I ever going to see her again?
Oh, yeah. That was constantly on your mind. It's like I said, I really didn't think I was going to make 23.
Well, I would have to think that getting back to the States and seeing her again felt pretty good. What was that moment like?
We didn't get back till September. And when we came in, I think we had maybe 500 gallons of diesel oil left. We came in on one engine halfway from Australia. I was the only child also. My mother wouldn't sign for me to go to the Navy. My dad had to sign. Anyway, things worked out for the best.
And you decided to stay in the Navy. You hadn't gotten enough with all those things you told us about in World War II?
I almost went to Highway Patrol in California, but the exam didn't come up until my enlistment was up, but I couldn't take the exam until 2 or 3 months after that. I didn't have that kind of time to wait out. And then, of course, the Korean War started.
When you ended up putting 20 years in, retiring as a chief warrant officer in 1960, you just mentioned the Korean War. What were you doing during those years?
Well, I was chief master at arms at Hunters Point sub part of that time. And the other part was on Sea Dog, another submarine. Some of that stuff was sort of uneventful, and you don't remember too much about it.
Here, you've been fooling us. It sounds like you remember just about everything. You're one of the last ones. There aren't too many submarine veterans from World War II around anymore. I can tell that you take pride in being one of them and that you carry on this legacy. So what do you think the rest of us should know about you and your fellow submarine vets from World War II?
Mainly, there wasn't any easy way. Like, I think the biggest thing is 2% of the Navy, and sank over half of the Japanese fleet, which was big. They finally got most of it in the Sea of Japan just to save it. At the end of the war, we had 100 submarines off the coast of Japan. They didn't have much room for any movement whatsoever.
Have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington?
Oh, yes. Honor Flight 2012, one of the first ones from here.
Well, the reason I ask is I'm thinking about those 3,500 submarine sailors who were killed in World War II. And you get there to Washington and you've got all those gold stars, 406,000. What did you think about when you were looking at that?
I thought how lucky I was.
And that didn't run out in World War II. Are you telling me the truth? That a year ago you had 35 staples in your head, you'd had bleeding on your brain, and people were getting ready for you to pass on?
Yes.
And I look at you right now, and man, you're telling me stories from 75 years ago, and you got a full head of hair, and you seem smarter and sharper than I am. What's going on here?
Well, you win some and you lose some. Uh-huh. But it just, I'm fortunate I've won more than I've lost. Whatever I'm doing, I may as well just keep doing it. It doesn't seem to be too bad.
Well, I don't want to leave out anything that you think is important, but I also don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing your incredible story with us. Is there something that you would say in looking back that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
The Navy was a great experience, and I have a lot of friends, or had a lot of friends. I don't anymore, from World War II, and we all had something in common. We all went through about the same thing.
Well, I know there can't be too many people out there listening who went through what you went through. Thanks again, Del Schwichtenberg of Carson City, Nevada. Big thanks also to Ken Beaton, an accomplished Carson City writer who connected me with his friend Del. And thank you for listening today. Don't forget to check out the photos online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with Honor.